So my name is Scott Pepin. I'm a professor at the law school here. I work on privacy and information technology and a bunch of other things. But more interesting, we have a great panel this morning to talk about, well, we'll see what we talk about, but I just asked them what they each think this panel is about, and we'll see where we end up. I am supposed to say a couple things up front. The first is, like all panels at CWA, we're going to be using the electronic question submission thing. If you have the app, I will just profess at the beginning, I have no idea how to use this thing, so I will try. But if you either don't trust me to do it right, or you don't want to use the app, you can also use note cards, which there are several producers around the room with note cards. The only thing I'll say is, number one, I have to be able to read it, so make it legible. And two, if you're a student, student questions, as always, get priority, but you have to indicate really clearly, either in the electronic submission or on the note card, that you're a student, because I can't know otherwise. So I don't promise we'll get to all the questions. We'll get to some for sure. Typical format towards the end, most likely. But if, as we go, questions that are coming in are relevant, I'll try to manage the inflow and work them into the conversation. Other than that, I am not big on very long introductions of the panelists, only because you have very long introductions of the panelists in written form, which if you haven't read, you should. I will say I was excited about this panel for one reason, which is these are three really interesting people. And this promises to be both weird and fun, which is for me a real highlight for an early morning, particularly right before what is supposed to be Snowmageddon. So it seems like a good thing. But let me say, starting at the other end, just who everyone is. Barrett Anderson is on the far end from me. She's the CEO and co-founder of Scout, which is a website that is, I will say, at least well-known, I won't say best-known, but for breaking the story in a lot of ways of Cambridge Analytica, which we're going to be talking about today, really doing some fascinating and innovative and very early work on that huge story that then eventually, almost a year later, hit the New York Times and everybody else on the planet. So it's wonderful to have you. Alexander Bard next to her, I have no idea how to describe you other than the way you describe yourself, Alexander, which is a cyber philosopher, a novelist, has many different books out there, the most recent being Digital Libido, a burner. There are lots of ways I could describe you, but a very interesting and fun participant. These three, by the way, were also on a roundtable yesterday here at CWA. And then right next to me is Will Hartling, lives in Portland, is a science fiction writer, six science fiction books. The most recent is Killswitch, and again, a very interesting sort of futurist and thinker about how all these different themes that we're going to be talking about interconnect, particularly if we veer into AI, which who knows if we will or not. So that said, I'm going to start. We just typically allow, you know, give each panelist 5 minutes or so to do their thing. I'm going to focus your thing a little bit. And starting with Barrett, just say, I want you each to tell the story of Cambridge Analytica in whatever way it means something to you. In other words, you don't have to tell all the facts and figures of what happened, although Barrett, you may want to, because it'd be helpful probably for everyone. But then what does this mean? What does this event signify? So let's start with you. Take it away.
Sounds good. Thank you. So I first was introduced to Cambridge Analytica in a bar in the East Village in New York, right after the 2016 election in the United States, here where we are. Sorry, we've been talking about all kinds of world places, so I felt the need to elucidate that, but you guys all get that. And I was with a friend of a friend, and she actually was working for Cambridge Analytica. And she had, the election had just happened, and she was drinking quite a bit. And she started telling us everything, but a lot of what they'd done and how they kind of thought about the election. And it was interesting because she's actually considers herself a Democrat. And she had been recruited over to Cambridge Analytica because they were able to pay more, basically. And so she was going through these kind of strange cycles of guilt and pride at how much they had, she felt that they had won the election and really been instrumental in making that happen. And at that point, I started kind of digging in and doing a bunch of research, right? That was a pretty interesting thing to hear about. I was already really interested in why there was such a big discrepancy in the 2016 election between the polling numbers ahead of time, bigger discrepancy than ever before between the polling numbers and the actual turnout, also bigger discrepancy than ever before between the exit polling numbers and the actual results of the election, which I found to be really interesting because there's not normally that kind of discrepancy. So just started digging in, and what we found was kind of the beginning of this machine, if you will. So essentially what happened is that Silicon Valley spent the last 10 years building digital addiction machines, and in 2016, Facebook, Cambridge Analytica, and Russia weaponized them. And Facebook, Google, and Twitter were kind of the main platforms that were used, right? But essentially, there's a really interesting researcher, I'm blanking on his name at the moment, of course, but hopefully it'll come up in a minute, but he was the first person right after the election. He did this kind of scan of the web, and what he found is that in addition to normal websites, like the New York Times or Fox News, for example, which have a lot of people linking into their sites, there was a shadow network of conservative sites and fake news sites that were all linking out to each other. And what that did is actually gained search engine optimization, right? So Google, if you're searching for information about the election on Google, they're going to show you the sites with the most links in, right? And so the result was that this network of sites was automatically linking to each other anytime they posted something, some new piece of information. And what that did is it shot all of that new information, which was extremely biased and or fake, to the top of search results so that people were then able to, you know, they would see that ahead of some more, you know, well-researched pieces. And so using that network, they actually then started tracking people using advertising cookies, right? And that what that means is it follows you around the web. It looks at what else you're interested in. It looks at kind of like the other kinds of websites that you're thinking about, which articles in particular speak to you. And then they used that information to retarget through Facebook to help kind of convert interest groups, if you will, or political groups. And so both Russia and Cambridge Analytica were doing this. They were using really, really similar tactics, if not the same tactics. And the overall strategy was to target specific groups of Americans, to polarize them. So they focused a lot on the right, clearly, but they also focused on the left, right? So they had Facebook groups that were focused on Black Lives Matter. They had Facebook groups that were focused on gay rights. They had Facebook groups that were focused on, pro-Muslim rights. And there was this really interesting thing where they then used that, because 2016 was actually the first election year where Facebook had integrated all of this data from big data warehouses, right? And so for the first time, you were able as an advertiser to target people by zip code and by income level, which means that in the U.S. election system, you are able to, using a pretty small contingency of people, target really closely people in swing states and specifically in swing districts, test which messages work well for them, and then, you know, use that to try to polarize communities within those districts. And the overall strategy was to try to get out right-wing voters or more conservative voters, to suppress voters who had backed Bernie in the primary, and to tell them that the election didn't matter and get them to vote for other folks. And in fact, that was actually very successful. So 2016 election, there was a much bigger discrepancy between independent voters who didn't vote or voted third party than there ever has been in the past. And then to suppress other communities of voters, such as, you know, Black voters in Florida, who by kind of telling them that voting didn't matter, or by confusing them with information about polling locations or polling details, right, or elections, or their ability to vote, right? So a big part of the strategy is just to create giant pandemonium and confusion. And the last part of this is that, I mean, this happened also on Twitter, and those things kind of go hand in hand, but on Twitter they had this, what are called, you know, in Russia especially, had a focus on troll farms. So they would essentially just run huge armies of fake profiles that were posing as Americans, and American citizens. And interestingly enough, there's the work, some work out of Oxford, the Oxford Internet Institute, which really has been tracking this since the Arab Spring, right? So they started following Twitter and Twitter, how Twitter was being used back when it was actually helping to kind of create revolutions and act as a breeding ground and an incubator for citizens who were really feeling that they needed to organize to protect their rights. But what they saw during that time was that that same, you know, it worked really well for a little bit, but at the same time, the government very quickly caught on, and during the Arab Spring actually started using Twitter to monitor those groups and then target them and kind of confuse them. So those same, interestingly enough, those same accounts that were used in the Arab Spring were actually decommissioned, re-popped up and used in the Brexit campaign with British profiles, profile pictures and bios, decommissioned and re-popped up in the US election. Right? So you can actually trace a lot of those accounts across multiple instances of information warfare. So that was kind of the scope of that. And I'll stop there because I know I've been talking for a while.
And I have one question that already came in, which is just to what extent and do we know whether Cambridge Analytica and Russia were working together or totally separately, or do we have no idea?
Well, it's a little hard to tell. I will say that their strategies and their tactics were exactly the same. My personal belief is that they were definitely working together, but clearly it's hard to point to specific evidence. All I know is that it would be really weird if they weren't working together, given the level of coordination that was going on to advance toward a specific goal and the same tactics and strategies.
So, Barry, you've called this a weaponized AI propaganda machine, right? So, Alexander, what?
Okay, America only gets what it deserves, okay? You don't think America's fiddling with elections in other countries? Come on! Let's not be naive, let's stop being naive here. And Obama was the light version of the same thing, in a way, so it was bound to happen. I've written about this for the last 25 years, and interestingly enough, in this case, is that my first book, The Netocrats, which came out in the year 2000, was a huge bestseller in Russia 3 years later. So all these guys who work with Putin now know who I am, right? So and basically what I've told them is, this is going to happen, you might as well do it, because otherwise your enemy will do it. You know, it's that's what's going to happen. Now, to me, the interesting question is, because everything Barry says is absolutely correct and wonderful, that's the journalistic scope of the whole thing. The other thing is this. How could America become so vulnerable? I think that's a much more interesting question. I remember when I came when I was 70 years old to America the first time, and I loved this country. It was very welcoming. And I went to college. I went to Oberlin College, like the social justice warrior harem, if anyone. And you know, every morning you wake up and you had this pledge of allegiance to the flag. You know, you all do that. And you think other people do that the rest of the world. I come from Sweden. Swedes have been Swedes for 2,000 years or whatever. We don't pledge allegiance to flag. We don't even have flags. Because we know we're Swedish. The problem is American identity is a very, very weak identity. It's incredibly weak. That's why you wave the flag all the time. You sing, you know, God bless America. You claim that America is so damn important. But what really happened was that America was basically a place that was colonized by Europeans with ADHD diagnoses in the 19th century. They went all over the place and killed anything they could find. You know, bitching, complaining about Israel and Palestine. It's a bit hypocritical. I mean, you took Hawaii in 1959. Come on. You can't say China, Tibet is that unfair, right? You do the same things in America that everybody else does. But the problem with America is that America now has, I would say clearly, number one, the American dream is dead. What I mean by that, it probably never existed, but at least people believed in it. The Donald Trump campaign was basically nostalgia for what if we dreamed that we could go back to having the American dream again. It's a bit like believing in God when you know God does not exist. Then you get Jordan Peterson, by the way, another American phenomenon. But so the problem with that is that the two major thinkers from Europe that hiddenly have more influence on America than anybody else, still, number one is Descartes. You still believe in America and the individual. You're probably the only people in the world who do that. The rest of us are all tribal by now. So I think, therefore, I am. It's like the ultimate American state religion. That's why everything in America is like the individual versus the state, the individual versus the corporation, the individual collecting your own data, having control of your own data, when in reality, that's not how society works and never was. And the other one is Rousseau. And I want to point to Rousseau and Rousseauism here, because that's when it gets really dangerous. What I'm concerned with is not that this happened. when a conservative is going to happen again and again and again, and Americans are going to try to do the same thing in other countries. Because this is how the internet works. If you get, hey, I work with Edward Snowden, I work with Julian Assange, and Edward Snowden is a hero in the rest of the world. I don't know about you guys, but he's a hero. Because he exposed basically that, well, if you let all the internet traffic of the world pass through U.S. territory, there's no way the American government is not going to eavesdrop on everybody on the planet. Because that's what the American and the Chinese do. They can't help themselves. Oh, I can listen to this guy's conversation. I will. And I'll register it all forever so I can eternally condemn this person for anything they did 45 years ago whenever I like to. That's so American, right? So the problem here is this. Rousseauism means this. America now, the American dream is dead. There's no shared narrative in this country any longer. That means America has gone tribal in a very, very destructive way. Because the tribes in America are not celebrating heroism the way America used to, when you had the American dream. It's celebrating victimhood on a massive scale. So what happened was you got identitarianism, which I refuse to think has anything to do with left. I'm a proper Marxist, sorry, right? So it means this. Let's find somebody to blame for our faults and our defects and for anything that doesn't work for us. Hitler did it with the Jew. Stalin did it with the Kulak. Rousseau is very popular in history. So in America today, it's at least a softer version of that. It's basically this. Let's blame everything on somebody else. I don't have to deal with my own shit. And it turned out for a while that it became more and more the white, heterosexual, working class man. Now, there was only a question of time before the white, heterosexual, working class man would go online and find other white, heterosexual, working class men who are also pissed off because now they are the victims. And they get the alt-right. The identity left gave birth to the alt-right. So what we're seeing now is the digitally driven tribal information warfare that's not between America and the rest of the world. It's not between America and the Russians. It's in within America. America is obsessed with Islamist terrorists arriving here. They couldn't care less. You're going to have your own terrorists. Because you're going to have hipsters in Portland 10 years from now who build bombs, put them on drones because they find the recipes for the bomb making online. And then they throw these bombs to Michigan. In Michigan, they find a disgruntled former Trump voter who didn't get the car factory Trump promised him. So he's going to build another bomb and send that off to Portland. And there you go. Probably Civil War II, very likely in the next 30 years. You don't have a shared narrative in this country any longer. That is your main problem. What does it mean to be American? But apparently it doesn't mean anything. It means to have grievances against somebody and not dealing with your own shit but blaming somebody else. And there can only be one way forward if that happens in a culture. It's downwards.
I told you.
And I love you guys. Can we work together?
Will lives in Portland, so I'm worried for your safety.
You're up.
The hipsters in Portland are too stoned to work with the motivation to build bombs. That's the only thing saving us. More medication. I'm going to just take a different tact on this for a moment. A long time ago, before everything came to us by the internet, I noticed this little problem that I had, which was that every so often I'd really want a new car. And it would become this crushing thing where I'd be completely dissatisfied with my car and my life, and then it would pass, and I would be like, why was I even thinking about that? And then some time would go by, and I'd be very unhappy with my car and considering these fiscally irresponsible decisions to go buy a new car even though I couldn't afford one. And then eventually what I realized was my dissatisfaction correlated with car and driver showing up on my doorstep once a month. And I was taking in this information that was creating unhappiness. And this happened at a time when you could see this, right? Because it only came once a month. It wasn't all the time. And one of the biggest differences now is everything that we're embedded in is pervasive. It's all the time. So it's not only is the message being reinforced more and it's more effective, but we can't ever really escape it. We can't get out of the system to notice the effect that the messages are having on us. And that's one of the biggest differences, I think. And so even if you are attempting to be self-aware, even if you're attempting to notice the influence of information on you, you can't get outside of it to notice it. So that's, I think, one of the biggest issues facing us. I also agree one of my books writes a lot about the fact that as we move to, say, a post-scarcity economy, assuming we survive that long, what will people do with themselves? And I think this is part of the issue that Alexander is bringing up, is that most people don't have a template for how to live their lives, and so they are reduced to just complaining about things because there isn't necessarily a drive for, well, what do I do? So I think that's actually a big, huge, pressing issue. And even if we do survive the next 10 years, as unemployment rises, skyrockets, we may be at 50% unemployment in 20 years, that issue is going to magnify even more, because if you have half your people who don't derive any meaning from their employment, then where do they go?
So staying for a second with the theme that's in the handout, right, which is, so okay, we have no shared identity, we have factions, we have, you know, maybe they go to the extreme you're describing, maybe they don't. But what you're describing, Jared, is these factions are being manipulated, they're being weaponized, they're being provoked. The unhappiness is being provoked. It's not just the car and driver shows up because you chose to get car and driver. You're being sent the digital equivalent of car and driver by Cambridge Analytica or by the Russians or by whoever the hell's using the technology, and it's making you
Everyone's
unhappy.
Everyone's using it now, actually.
Everybody, yeah. Right? We're using it. You're being made unhappy, which is continuing to provoke what Alexander's talking about. So how do we... What is the right question, the question in the pamphlet, which is, what does the internet know about you? Or is the question, for what purpose is what's known about you being used?
Well, I want to... Before we dive into that, I want to push back a little bit on what Alexander had to say about Europe and the United States. Because, you know, whether or not it's debate, sure, we can debate whether or not America has an identity or there is such a thing as an American identity. But this is a problem that's not just happening in the U.S., right? So this is a problem that is widespread across Europe. I think the big difference between European countries and the United States, they're experiencing very similar problems, right? All of the same issues that are being weaponized here in the United States are also being weaponized in Europe, and they're working. So if the problem is that the problem is not that we don't have a national identity. The problem is that there are widespread cultural issues, some of which we've touched on a little bit here today. Immigration is one that is really, really frequently weaponized, right? And was weaponized very successfully all across Europe. Was it weaponized in the Greek election, in the German election, in Brexit, you know, all across, in Sweden, there's a huge problem with this as well. And so it's really problematic to say that this is just a U.S. problem. It's not. It's widespread around, all around the world. It's being used everywhere. The other thing that I wanted to just dive... Okay, so remind me of your question, actual question.
Well, he wants to jump in before I even get to it, so...
Yeah, I agree with Barrett. That's exactly the thing. But the other side of the coin is the reception. Okay, what is inside of me that can receive these messages, and how do I then process them? And the problem is that news media have for the past 100 years been fake news. People are discovering they cannot trust the old institutions like newspapers, radio, television. Number one, all these old institutions, media institutions, are defending their own interests to begin with. That's the first thing they do. So they hate anything that's new because it actually takes power away from them. So it's like I say, my students in Sweden, for example, they said, how about fake news? I said, well, you know Dagens Nyheter, the biggest Swedish daily newspaper, which is the New York Times of Scandinavia. Okay, they haven't written a single word of truth about me for the past 30 years. So why would you believe them in that case? And take Brexit, for example, another European example. I believe Brexit happened because nationalism has to be refounded. There has to be nationalism that works before people can start to accept a more global system. A higher level of complexity than the nation state is. So Brexit essentially happened because people in England felt that Brussels was a construction they had not participated in creating. There was no narrative about it that involved them. It was all about France and Germany to begin with. So they shouldn't be there. So I think Brexit was healthy in the sense that, if it happens, that the European Union got a kick in the ass. Like, if you guys don't get more democratic and come back to the people with a story why you should exist in the first place, there's no reception for you. So I look at the humans. I think we could work perfectly well together because you can look at either what's coming at you, and that's got to be more and more manipulative. more and more going into your, you know, into the cells of your body, into the cells of your soul. They're going to know more and more about you. I mean, we can't stop that from happening. That's my whole point. I've written about it for 25 years. There's a reason for that. But I think I can, as a philosopher, affect the reception that we human beings have. And that is to be more critical about where these things come from and have a narrative about ourselves and the society we live in that actually works for us. That narrative is now lacking. America doesn't have a narrative. That's exactly why America is so sensitive. And the same thing for Britain. They had one narrative, it's called the British Empire. This is the last remnants of the British Empire falling apart. Even Britain itself is now falling apart. Scotland goes independent, maybe for the better in the long run. Because we have to now find subsidiarity. Subsidiarity means that I can relate to my politicians on a personal level. I can relate to them. There's a shared narrative of our community that we all believe in. That means we don't have to pledge allegiance to anything in the morning. We believe in this community. And if that doesn't exist there, then I'll be incredibly vulnerable to any kind of message I will get, especially when it's so well designed as it's going to be now.
Yeah, the one thing that occurs to me is that we... The assumption is that the channel remains the same. That social media as it exists today, which has... I got my start in online culture in the 1980s, so it's like I've been living online for a very long time. And one of the things that I've noticed and written about and studied about is the fact that basically online culture doesn't really work for us as human beings anymore. Like, it seemed super attractive for a very long time, but social media gives us the illusion of being connected. We're not really connected. It gives us these dopamine hits that substitute for forming an emotional, it's a substitute for an actual emotional relationship with somebody.